All right, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. And we are here to talk about the movie Obsession. I'm obsessed! And there's going to be spoilers. So if you haven't seen it, stop listening, go see it. Don't pirate it! It's a movie that's well worth giving some money to because it's a YouTube creator who created a short, I think, called The Chair, short horror movie, then got an offer for a longer movie. And this movie was shot for like $1 million in a little over 20 days and is grossing massive amounts of cash and well-deserved success. And so we want to, I think, do our part to promote independent creators and all that kind of good stuff. So please, please, please give them your money. So I'm going to go over the plot real briefly. And then I tell you about some of the layers in it. Because, you know, it's striking a real chord with people. And when stuff strikes a real chord with people, we kind of want to ask why and figure it out. And yeah, it's good goosebumpy stuff. So there's this guy in the movie. His full name is Baron Bailey, but everyone refers to him as Bear. Now, I don't know if this is a nod to the feminist trope that they would rather choose a bear in the woods than a man in the woods. But anyway, so he's this kind of shy, awkward, pathetic guy who works at a small music store, which seems kind of old-fashioned, to put it mildly, and has a few strange things on the lunch menu. And he's got a bad haircut, and he's pale, and he has no body shape at all. He's like, if you just took some plastic and rolled it together and stuck it together, you'd end up with the forgettable face. Forgettable hair, forgettable body, no particular charisma or energy or effort. So he's working at this music store with Nikki, who's his longtime crush, the girl he crushes on, Ian and Sarah. He's been pining hard for Nikki forever and a day. Maybe they were childhood friends or something like that. But he's too scared to make a move. Oh, yeah, how many people have I talked to over the years? How many men in particular have I talked to over the years? Who will not make the move? Who just float around in that dead-ass satin friend zone from hell? Neither close enough to land on the planet nor far enough to break orbit and find a new home. He's just pining and wanting. And certainly his best friend knows. One of the few people in their early 20s who already look like an accountant. It's really quite remarkable. He's got that middle-aged haircut, that pasty face, and a hanging chin. You know, hey, I have one, too, but hey, I'm pushing 60, so that's a different matter. So one night, Bear's cat, Sandy, accidentally ODs on Bear's grandma's pills. Bear's grandma got sick, and he ended up moving into his house, and because he has no personality, apparently, whatsoever. He doesn't change up the house. He just basically leaves it the same way that it was when his grandmother was there, which is to say, old, windowless. It's like one of the few houses that actually seems like it's constructed almost entirely in a basement. All of her old stuff is there. All of her old medication is there. And his cat gets into the meds and dies. And you know, it's kind of a real thing that if you can't take care of a cat, maybe you shouldn't be having a family. You know, just a thought, just a possibility. So what happens is he's talking to Nikki, and Nikki says, oh, I lost my necklace or something like that. And he ends up going to this creepy old store to get a necklace, and he gets this one wish willow twig, and the shop lady pitches it as a one-time wish granter. And there's a sort of theme where the people who were in charge of these kinds of powers are indifferent to you. They're indifferent to you. And that's shades of politics, right? Politicians are indifferent to you. They don't care what you want. They only care that you vote for them, accept their lies, pay your bills, and die quickly, like the 100K plus on the medically assisted induced death in Canada. So everyone's indifferent to him because he's got no personality, he's got no will, he's got no sense of self, he's got no identity, and he has the kind of bad haircut that a low-lying airborne lawnmower might give you as it flew past. I tell you, man, I don't have hair, but if haircut is makeup for men. Haircuts are makeup for men. For God's sakes, go and get a proper haircut. So he buys this little wish willow twig. It'll be cute for her. Later that night, they go to where? Where do they go? Where do they go? It's very clever. I don't know if it's conscious or not. They go to trivia night because their lives are dun 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 trivial. Yes, that's right. Like, no, their lives are trivial. So they go to trivia night and they have no plans, no future, stuck in that early 20s. Hey, that's my bike, Reality Bites. Endless copy-paste nihilism day. So he, Bear, drives Nikki home. And the actress, by the way, of course, carries the movie. I think Bear is underrated as an actor because everyone's focusing on the woman's performance, which is fantastic, but he's also very good. To get that emptiness and have you have sympathy for somebody who's foundationally doesn't exist as a person is a good challenge as an actor. So she says to him, "Do you like me? Now's the time to say it." Now, does that mean that there's a possibility she might like him? I mean, she likes him, obviously, as a friend. And there's a whole incestuous thing that's going on as a whole, which we'll get into later, in that she views him as a younger brother. And these are four friends clinging to each other as a kind of amorphous family because there are no adults, no parents, no fathers, no mothers, no aunts, no uncles. The only grandparent is the dead one who gave him the house, gave Bear the house after she died. And so there's no adults here. Well, there's this elderly, selfish boomer who, when one of the friends doesn't get into college, he just says, "Oh, well, you'll get in somewhere. Now get back to work." Right? So the only adult. So, of course, they don't have much personality. They don't have much purpose because they have no culture. They have no parenting. They have no religion. They have no philosophy. They have no virtues. They have no values. And they're just kind of chasing hedonism for no particular purpose. So she says to him, "Do you like me? Now's the time to tell me." What "now's the time to tell me" means that she's quite receptive. Doesn't mean that she'll say yes. But this is the interesting thing, because the whole question is, well, one of the questions, would she have been with him if he'd asked her? Well, of course, if he had said to her, "Yes, I have feelings for you," then he would be a different kind of guy. He would be a different kind of guy. So she says, "Do you like me? Now's the time to tell me." Now's the time to tell me, right? They're outside her place. She doesn't seem to have anyone else inside the place because later she asks them in. So now's the time to tell me, because she's going to leave the store. She's going to go be a writer. She wants, "Now's the time to tell me" is an invitation. Now is the time to tell me. Direct invitation. Just tell the truth. You know, you can't be friends with someone if you're attracted to them and you're lying about it. You can't do it. It's a falsehood. It is lying by omission. It is thou shalt, thou are, thou wilt be bearing false witness for now and forever. So she's asking him to tell the truth, to be honest. And of course, the reality is, women, and in particular young women, are finely attuned to people who like them. Of course they are. That's kind of the evolutionary business of young women, is to figure out who likes them and who is the best they can get. Who likes them and who is the best they can get? A woman wants to get the best guy. A guy wants to get the best woman. Now, there are only the top one or two men and women in the whole world, and they're probably going to marry each other. Doesn't mean they'll be happy, Brangelina, but everyone else, we have to settle for who we can get. I guess Elon Musk is the world's first trillionaire, made more in one day than Bill Gates' entire fortune. Bill Gates worth, what, $150 billion? Apparently a good haircut costs $151 billion. So Elon Musk is the richest guy in the world. And everyone else, well, we get what we can get. We negotiate for what we get. We ask for what we can get. freedomain.com/donate. If you'd like to help out philosophy, we'd really appreciate that. So he lies to her because he's frightened. Why is he frightened? He has no male role models in his life. He's raised by his grandmother, which means he's an orphan. His parents are gone. At best, he had a single mother. no father, no one to teach him how to be a man, raised in an anti-male society where males are at best considered broken boys, broken girls to be medicated into the kind of torpor that girls often express or show or don't show in school. So, he's lying to her. He's lying to her because he's afraid. And what does he like about her? Now, she's shown to be kind, but there's an interesting thing. So, Nikki, after they leave trivia, says to her friend, do you have any cash? Her friend says, yeah, I got $20. Nikki grabs it, says, I'll pay you back later, and goes and gives it to a homeless person who's leaning up against the wall. Now, if that ain't the welfare state, I don't know what is. And they, let me weave it in. Let me give me some latitude to weave this stuff in. If that's not the welfare state, I don't know what is. I'll take your money. I'll pay it back. You know she's not going to. I'll take your money, and I'll view myself as kind by giving other people your money, right? That's the welfare state. That's migrants. That's old age pensions. That's all of the stuff where women in general want to feel like they're good, kind, and generous people, and they, through the power of politics, take resources, mostly from men, give it to others, and feel like good people. That's a telling detail, because there's no reason why Nikki couldn't have pulled out her own money and given it to the homeless person. Say, well, she didn't have the money. It's like, no, that's a writer's choice. The writer can have $20 on her. Instead, the writer has to go to someone else. The unearned. This is all about the movie. The whole movie's about the unearned and how it destroys everyone. All evil, all corruption, all immorality is based upon the desire to get the unearned. The unearned. So, she says, do you like me? Now's the time to tell me. And he chickens out and she leaves. He's incredibly frustrated. And also, by the by, his douchebag friend, Ian, I think it is. His douchebag friend, who's secretly, spoiler, secretly sleeping with Nikki off and on, tells him to make fun of her, to mock her, and so on, right? The negging kind of stuff. So he calls her Freaky Nikki, which apparently was a bad nickname for her. So he tries, his friend says, oh, you've got nothing but time. Just delay, time. And this is kind of demonic, right? The friend Ian is an underappreciated villain in the whole story because Ian is lying to Bear, hiding his friends with benefits relationship with Nikki and giving him terrible advice because he wants to keep getting his Freaky Nikki Nookie. I'm sure that was the original name of the movie, Freaky Nikki Nookie. So he lies to his friend, gives him bad advice, and so on. So Bear can't be honest with Nikki and chickens out and then gets incredibly frustrated. And he snaps the willow in half, which gives him the wish, and he wishes, I want Nikki to love me more than anyone else in the whole effing world. And then Nikki comes back, and you can see her, and the actress is great, almost being dragged. She's kind of coming and going. She's kind of possessed. She's been split into two. Wish Nikki and real Nikki. And we'll see the divergence of these two characters as they go forward. And then she lies about her dad having cancer so she can crash at his place. I remember when I was younger, a woman tried this with me. I'm having a terrible time at home. I just need to crash at your place for a night or two. I had to fend her off because it wasn't someone I wanted to date. But people try that. They try that sort of stuff. So they hook up. And then there's a really nice romance fantasy sequence. They're watching movies and she's staring at him rather than staring at the movie. And they're cooking together and they're having a fun little montage and so on, right? Well, that's not great over time. Now, this is called fusion in sort of technical language. And fusion is when people crash together, they have a lot of sex, affection, touch, physicality, and they re-enter that taken care of baby swaddling phase of early infancy, and they bond completely with no judgment, no morals, no virtues, no trust, no integrity, no honesty. They just merge together. It's like tying two octopuses together in sailor's knots. And then, of course, what happens in reality, when you get this kind of love bombing, is that they're totally wound in together and They have simply bonded biochemically, bonding hormones and so on. All they've done is they've bonded biochemically, but they haven't learned to trust each other based upon virtue, temptation, honesty, integrity, moral courage, you know, that kind of stuff. Because we can only trust virtue in people. Virtue is that which allows us to trust other people. If I say I'm going to do something, and if I move heaven and earth to try and always make my promises come true, then you can trust me. If I'm lying and slimy and cheat and, right, then you can't trust me. The only thing we can trust in each other is virtue. And when people crash, boom, bang together, making the beast with two backs and winding into each other like pouring red dye number 9 into a cup of milk, well, they then are merged and joined, and their bodies think that pregnancy and babies and a lifelong union is together. And then they wake up and say, holy crap, I can't trust this person at all. I don't even know. And then crazy stuff starts happening. So we'll get into the rest of the story. But the movie opens in a very interesting way. Of course, the movie's obsession, and we kind of know what it's about. It opens up with the actor staring into the camera, the young man, Bear, saying, you're the only person that I've ever... Sorry, stupid. I don't talk like this. I feel like I'm coming apart. I think about you all the time, Nikki. When I try not to, you're in every song I listen to. You were the only person that was nice to me when I moved here. And at first I thought, maybe you... Well, I realized who you are. And then after Nana passed, you were the one that called, even when I didn't have anything to say, we just sat there. So I kept telling myself, don't tell her, she's too good, and you'll lose her. But maybe you should know that I would choose you over everything. Now, that's a very telling monologue, right? Which is, I feel like I'm coming apart. I think about you all the time, Nikki. Now, I don't know if you've ever been obsessed with someone. I have. And it is crazy intrusive. It's like a toothache. It's like an itch you can't scratch. You dream about it. You wake up. You think. I have gone through that. And it's not particularly easy, to put it mildly. But he wants to milk and mine love for his own benefit, to fill up the void, the hole, the emptiness within himself, to ingest another person. It's kind of an emotional cannibalism. Which is, I feel sad, I feel depressed, I feel empty, I feel lonely. Feed me, feed me, feed me. Love, see, love doesn't exist for you. Love doesn't exist for me. Why is there love? Just from a very practical evolutionary standpoint, why is there love? Well, there's love because we have these giant brains that take forever to mature. 20 years! You see, a horse drops out of its mom, can walk within a day or two, human beings take 10 months, 12 months, 14 months, depending on the race, on average. Blacks tend to gain physical dexterity faster, and East Asians later or last. So love is not for you. Love is not for me. Love is a biochemical, foundational, we could say spiritual as well, experience that exists so that we pair bond in order to raise our children well. Rabbits have lust, not love, because rabbits bang and move on, bang and move on, bang. It's like just the conveyor belts of wee bunny for JJs and so on. They're on pair bond. They are selected creatures, the top of the food chain, the predators, the wolves, the polar bears, and humans. We pair bond because we have a lot of information to impart upon our children. We have to teach them how to hunt. We, of course, have to teach our children how to speak, how to socialize, how to move within complex social rules. So love exists for children. It does not exist for you to feel better. It does not exist for me to feel better. It's a lovely experience, of course. But love only exists for children. And none of these adult children are going to have children anytime soon. None of them talk about it. None of them think about it. There's no talk of marriage or children or continuing the line or anything like that. It's just, I want, I want, I want. Sexual desire exists, what, to make you feel good? Nope. No, it's necessary to make you feel good. In order to get you, what does it mean your driver said in some movie? It's like putting your finger up someone's nose, right? So sexual desire exists so that you'll do these ridiculous things with people to make babies. But it's not to make you feel good. Making you feel good is a necessary mechanism to have you reproduce. Love sex, pair bonding, all of the lovely, happy, happy, joy, joy, endorphin chemicals that bind us to each other exist because children take forever to raise. And people want to hijack love and keep it just for themselves. Now, one of the great fears of women, there's a woman who memorably said this, that she would rather be a fleshlight for an alpha than be married to a beta. This is female lust. A female lust, and I have no problem with lust, just to be clear, lust is a fine emotion. But female lust is to get the tallest, most attractive, most confident, strongest male possible for two reasons. One, they want to have tall, strong, successful offspring, in particular boys. And number two, they are looking for a protector, right? Women have a fantastic sense of when society is going badly. And as society goes worse and worse, to some degree, arguably in part because women vote with their hearts, not their heads, not that all men don't, but a little bit more women do. So when society starts going really badly, women start gravitating towards protectors, and they're willing to be in a harem to get an alpha male. And they don't have to worry about being provided for because the government basically forces everyone to hire women, and there's old age pensions, there's free healthcare, there's welfare, alimony, child support, you name it, to support women. The entire purpose of the modern government seems to be to transfer as much money as humanly possible from men to women, so that women end up as sexual harem members to alphas. Because when in the past women would get impregnated and they would basically spend 20 years having children and then the next 20 years taking care of grandchildren, well, they needed a provider, and therefore they had to settle, as we all do, for somebody who's good enough. Who's good enough? Not perfect, whatever that would mean, but good enough. Women don't have to settle anymore because the government takes care of their bills directly and indirectly. So they can just chase the alpha, they can have hot sex with the alpha, and then, you know, maybe later, you know, women generally always land on their back, their feet. And so later they can get a guy to pay their bills, whether it's the government or something like that, and they can get their can't-be-fired government jobs, and although they can go into debt, and they can get some guy to pay off their debt, or the government will forgive their debt, or something like that. So the great fear of modern women is to get pair bonded with a beta. To get pair bonded with a beta is a great terror. And one of the ways that women get pair bonded with betas is they're nice to betas. Nikki, if you don't mind the fact that she's about as tall as a garden gnome, Nikki is a solid 8 or 9. Bear, the guy, 5. You know, if he had a good haircut, he might get to 6.5. And like attracts like. So, and the guy she's hooking up with is like a 3 or a 4. It's like a middle-aged accountant, as I mentioned before, wearing the skin suit of a guy in his early 20s. It's kind of weird. Kind of weird. So, obviously, there's something wrong with Nikki that she's hooking up with him. But this guy was cast not for his looks, because I think he was the roommate of the filmmaker, which is kind of interesting. And so, great fear. Women, we're nice to betas. We get attention from betas. They'll do nice things for us. They'll help us move. They'll help us with our essays. They know how to fix a printer. They'll drive us home. We don't have to get a car. I mean, being friends with a beta can save a woman easy $10,000 a year. Easy $10,000 a year. And the emotional attention and support. And so, for women, there are direct financial incentives to have betas around, but the great danger is the beta falls for you. And she gives off some big signals, so when the guy says at the after the trivia night, says, drive your girl home, and she's like, ew, don't say it like that. In the same way that if he was a younger brother, drive your girl home, not your sister, but your girl, right? And then she says, he says to her, I got you something. She says, oh, why does it make me nervous? Why does it make me nervous? Because she knows that the beta might make a play for her. The beta might make a play for her. And then what? Well, she has to reject the beta. The beta is unpredictable when he's rejected. The beta is unpredictable when he's rejected. So he makes the wish on this willow tree magic stick. Love me more than anyone. More than anyone. Not just love me. Not just, or he could have wished. Wouldn't that make sense? Couldn't he have wished for the confidence to tell her how he feels? But he doesn't want that, you see, because if he has the confidence to tell her how he feels, she might say no. He wants the guaranteed love. He wants the unearned. He wants her attention, devotion, sexual access, obsession. He wants that. He doesn't want to earn it by getting a decent haircut, working out a little maybe, developing his confidence, developing his storytelling ability, capacity to make jokes, whatever it's going to be. He doesn't want to do that because that's work. He wants something for nothing. He wants something for nothing. This is government debt. This is the welfare state, old age pensions, quote, free health care, money printing, stimmy checks during COVID. Everybody wants something for nothing. And the government will always offer something, quote, for nothing. And then it destroys your society or steals your soul. Desire for the unearned is horrible if you don't get it, but even more horrible if you do get it. And a desire for the unearned paralyzes people from their potential almost every day. If there's one idea that I could, if I had my wish, I wouldn't use it, but if I had my wish and I wanted to use it, I would say, please remove from people's heads the desire for the unearned, right? So you go to a concert, there's some singer up there caterwauling away, and you're like, oh, I'd love to be that singer. Okay, well, take some singing lessons, see if you can sing, write songs, get a band, go play gigs, you know, work your way up. Desire for the unearned. I always wanted the world to listen to me because I thought I had some interesting things to say, some important, essential moral things to say. And it turns out that I did. And to some degree, the world is listening. That's nice. The desire for the unearned paralyzes people. Paralyzes people. The daydream. Wouldn't it be great if I was wealthy. If I was famous, if I was beautiful, I was talented. Liposuction. Nose jobs. Lifts and shoes, pretend watches. He wants the unearned. He wants her devotion without winning it. He wants her body, right? This is the important thing. We'll get into the pornography angle a little later, but he wants her body, not her soul, not her spirit, not her choice. He doesn't want to be chosen. He wants a sex slave because he is overriding her judgment. Her body, her choice, right? Without the sinister overtones regarding abortion, her body, her choice. Got to woo the woman. The woman's got to want you. Love me more than anyone. Now, here's the double chocolate layer cake creepiness of the movie, that he wants to make her completely dependent upon him and to love him more than anyone. In other words, he wants to turn her into a toddler, and you can't really understand the movie and its power over people, which is considerable. It's a great story. If you don't understand that he's turning her into a hypersexualized toddler, this is the really, really creepy element to the movie that I think is hitting people deep down. Because he turns her into a baby. Because children are, quote, obsessed with their parents because they can't get their sustenance or moral nutrition or emotional connection or food or shelter anywhere else. And she moves in with him and she never leaves. Like a child, when you bring him home from the hospital, they move in with you and they don't leave. And in the beginning, everything's great, right? They have that little montage of romantic, fun stuff. And then, in some indeterminate time later, what happens? Well, she begins to be more demanding, more needy, and he's frightened of her now. From the merging of mothers and fathers, in particular mothers with children, what I talked about earlier with fusion, why do we have the capacity for fusion? Because we have to do it with babies. Babies can't speak. You have to inhabit the mind of the baby to know what the baby wants without language. You've got to fuse your consciousness together. You've got to be super sensitive. You've got to understand your kid hugely well, because it's going to be many, many years before they have any kind of sophisticated language to tell you what they need. So the fusion exists for babies, and yet we use it with sex and romance all the time, and it's a disaster. It's a disaster. So his wish turns her into a child. She lies, she manipulates, she has no emotional control, she's violent, impulsive, and it's not even subtle, man. She doesn't leave the house. And what does she do when she doesn't leave the house? She pees herself. She poops herself. That's a toddler. It's a baby, 12 months, 10 months, 14 months, it's a baby. And if you've ever had kids and you're lying in bed and it's kind of late and the kid's not quite asleep and you try and extract yourself, what does the kid say? No, don't go. And what does she say? Stay, she says. Stay. Screams at him. He can't leave because she's had bad dreams. He can't leave the bedroom because she's had bad dreams. Well, that's what kids do. They'll come and get you because they had a bad dream and then you have to stay. She's a toddler. She's incredibly needy, as toddlers are. She's very aggressive, as toddlers are. Like, pound for pound, toddlers are by far the most violent people on earth. So there's the initial fusion, bonding, happy time of infancy, and then she becomes a toddler. And her needs are ferocious, and he doesn't have anything to give. If he had something to give, he wouldn't have needed to make the wish to have her love him. And when toddlers begin to disagree, when they begin to have demands, the parents often kind of freak out and get aggressive and feel paralyzed and frightened. And toddlers hate it when the parents leave. So what does she do? She duct tapes the whole door. She is a toddler in an adult body, which means this makes their sexual activity horrendous beyond words. So he wants a girl who's way out of his league. She's smarter than he is. She's a writer. She's more ambitious than he is. She's willing to quit a dead-end job so she can go and be a writer. She's way more attractive than he is. She's way more assertive than he is. She says what she needs before he possesses her with this wish willow thing. So she is better than he is. She's slumming it, which is unwise, and he is reaching for a goddess far beyond his grasp. That is pornography. Pornography is, I don't know, women do it too, right? So I'm not just talking males, right? Women want the Christian Grey guy who could do everything, has abs, and can be tamed and controlled and domesticated while still remaining angry, rageful, and competent in the outside world, all that kind of stuff. Violent outside, gentle at home, that's ambrosia for a lot of primitive women. So from the male angle, he is using a wish to get a woman that he can't get. Well, that's OnlyFans. That's paying for pornography. That's tipping. That's like I talked with this OnlyFans manager not too long ago. Back in the day, I talked with Tristan Tate about all of this sort of stuff. And so it's imagining a relationship that you're paying for that isn't real. It's not real. Her attraction to him isn't real. Her obsession with him isn't real. There's no relationship. It's all made up. It's all fantasy. And this is plain guys, average guys, no hate on the average. Average is fine. Betas, no hate on betas. Most people are, can't all be alphas. But this is average guys going for the Sophie Rain perfect fat deposit body goddesses and paying for stuff and imagining there's a relationship when there isn't. The girls online aren't with you. They pretend. They pretend. But it's not real. And what does he do? Well, he breaks a stick to make the wish. Breaks his, I mean, that would be phallic, right? He breaks his reproductive organ. And what happens? It's a very creepy scene where there's a phone number on the back. Sorry, I've been yelling the whole time. Sorry about that. So he calls the helpline on the back of the willow box. He says, basically, this is going really badly. This is going really badly. And in the chilling indifference, right? Evil used to be, wah, you know, sort of active. And now it's just like bored and indifferent because we deal with bureaucrats who do great evils, not robbers and thieves directly. So we are used to indifference as the cause of evil. The indifference to the grooming gangs scandals in England, 250,000 girls. Ugh. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. I'll scream myself hoarse if I get into that topic. I want to stay on this one for now. So in the scene, he calls the number. Apparently it's a real number and you can call it and get a recorded message. But so he calls the number, and there's an interesting sort of philosophical conversation. Basically, he says, well, it's not real. And he says, well, the fact that you made her do it doesn't make it any less real. And what he means by that is the reality of the physical proximity, the reality of the sexual activity, and so on, and the reality of the violence and danger that he's experiencing, the toddler screaming and being demanding and needy and violent. And then there's this really chilling scene where the indifferent guy is actually the writer director on the phone, playing the guy on the phone, says, hey, you wanna talk to Nikki? You wanna talk to her? And then you hear this screaming, right? So Nikki is, real Nikki is somewhere in hell, her soul has been captured, displaced, replaced. And that's where she is. She hates the situation. She feels like she's being assaulted in the worst kinds of ways because she's not in control of her body. It's a possession. It's a kind of possession. And at one point, of course, she whispers, you know, kill me, as he's getting up to leave to meet Sarah in a parking lot where things do not go very well. Beep, beep, beep. It's like the Roadrunner from hell. And she says, kill me, just kill me. She's sleeping. I can't stand this. Just kill me. She would rather. And he says, is it so bad to be with me? And she says, well, I've never been with you. But that's, again, that's the OnlyFans, pornography, prostitute situation. Because he's saying, be with me, like physically, which is what the guy, the creepy guy on the phone is saying. It's not any less real. She's with you, isn't she? She has sex with you, doesn't she? She's in your house, isn't she? Like in the, it puts the lotion on the skin kind of way. And he's selfish. Now, the slightly less stellar woman, who is Sarah, who's on his level and who pines for him, and who would be a better partner for him, of course, in general. She's good-natured. She actually cares about him. But he doesn't want her because she's not as pretty as Nikki. Nick, of course, is to steal. It's that great line from Top Secret. What's your name? Nick. Oh, where does that come from? I don't know. Just something my dad thought of while he was shaving. So the movie, of course, is about the thirst for the unearned that comes out of unmet childhood needs. If you were neglected, and neglect is what's all over in this movie, because nobody's going to any adults or parents or anything for help. They're all just lost children, completely isolated, ignored, we assume, by the adults in their lives. The grandmother was sick, left him this house, did not parent him. So they all have unmet needs from childhood. All of them. Because they're uncoached, untutored, unmentored. Nobody's given them a moral mission. Nobody's taught them about the necessity for virtue. Nobody's done any of that. So when you have unmet needs from childhood, early childhood in particular, you were ignored, you were lonely, then it's really tempting to go through life looking for how to fill up that void of emptiness, isolation, and solitude that comes from being neglected or abused. And abuse and neglect are usually two sides of the same coin, because the abuser will then have to ignore you when the abuser is calm, because the abuser doesn't want to feel guilt at having abused you. So you go from abuse to neglect to abuse to neglect. It leaves a giant hole in your heart. A hole in your heart the size of your heart. And we want to fill that hole up. We want to feel better. We want to not feel the agony of isolation, because we are tormented and tortured as children by neglect and isolation. In particular, it's even worse than direct physical abuse. Like, the worst is sexual abuse, the next worst is neglect, the next worst is emotional abuse, verbal abuse, and the least worst is physical abuse. We are tortured by isolation, tormented. Ostracism provokes in the brain the same patterns of agony that are produced by physical torture, because we are social animals, and because we cannot survive alone, our minds and our bodies punish us enormously for solitude and isolation. And in the modern world, we can achieve solitude and isolation. Well, it's kind of the default state in a lot of ways. Certainly was under COVID. This movie comes to some degree out of COVID. So these people all have these unmet needs, which means people should do stuff for us that we don't have to reciprocate. That's what being a little kid is. People do stuff for you and you don't have to reciprocate. I mean, you get a little fruit roll up as a baby, nobody charges you. Your parents drive you somewhere, they don't flip on the cab fare. There's no bills. You just exist in this pleasant state of being taken care of without any need for reciprocity. Especially when you're a toddler. You don't have to do chores, so you can't do much anyway. So you exist in this state of consumption, of non-reciprocity, of getting something in your mind for nothing. This is why people grow up with love of socialism and communism and all these other get me free stuff, free stuff, free stuff. Because there's an incomplete part of their childhood where they were supposed to get free stuff. Things were supposed to be non-reciprocal. You were supposed to be receiving love, care, attention. Now, of course, as a kid, you even as a baby, you'll give things back. Your parents make you laugh. You laugh, which encourages them to make you laugh more. But you don't have to do stuff for people. You are in a state of receiving, and you're supposed to be filled up by all of that receiving to the point where you can give in exchange for the rest of your life. Like, your parents are supposed to put $10 million in your emotional bank account when you're a baby and a toddler, and then you can trade and be relatively wealthy for the rest of your life. But if you've got nothing in your bank account from your parents, or a negative balance, a debt of trauma, then you're hungry. You're hungry to consume. You're hungry to absorb. You're hungry to be given to. And of course, a lot of people go to the government. A lot of people go to cults or even religions. They go for sex, drugs, rock and roll. They go for drinking, gambling, anything. Gambling is also like, give me something for nothing. Give me something for nothing. This thirst for the unearned. And it's demonic. It comes out of child abuse and neglect. And then as an adult, you want something for nothing. You feel terrible. You feel terrible because you're running on empty. You're running on negative. You haven't had any gas deposited. You got to push the car. It's exhausting. So you just want the damn thing towed so you don't have to push it all the time because you've got no gas. Got no gas. And these people are strangely torpid and non-energetic, just going through, just dragging themselves through their days. They are without fuel. Fuel is deposited in you when you're a little kid. And then you're supposed to get into more reciprocity, late single digits, end of the latency period, 10, 11, 12, beginning of puberty, teenage, supposed to start doing more reciprocity. And you should be eager. You should be eager for reciprocity as you get older, because if you've been raised well, you've been filled up with love, care, attention, value. You feel valuable. You feel like your parents care about you. They care about what you think. They care about what you feel. Your perspective, they want to know. What you're into, they want to understand. They love you. But none of these people, there are no parents here. I understand, like, it's a, basically it's a four-hander. So, but there's not even a mention in passing, except for Nikki's father, who she claims is dying of cancer. And everyone says, well, I thought she was totally, she hated him, right? She hates her dad, right? Which means her mother's not raised her well. How could she, right? She hates her father. And this sort of famous scene in the restaurant, no, 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 no. Like the scene where he's like trying to confront her about lying about her father dying of cancer. And she's like, no, 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 no. I thought we had, that's a tantrum, right? That's a tantrum. That's what toddlers do sometimes when they don't get their way. If they don't think they'll be listened to. That's what toddlers do. They escalate, they make a scene, and the parents are, oh, shush, shush, okay, 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 shush, it's okay, it's okay. But they appease, right? This is what. And talk about the desire for the unearned. There's a really charming, there's not a lot of comedy in the movie, but there's a sort of charming little bit of writing where he's talking about the three-bite critic, right? He wants to be paid lots of money to just go and give food reviews, right? And then she says, hey, what do you think of this bread? Ah, it's a little dry, you know, I'll give it a 3 out of 5, and that'll be $100, right? So he even wants to get paid for almost nothing, for like making a couple of comments. I know it's a joke and all of that, but again, the theme is forever and ever, amen, desire for the unearned. Now, the only person who actually wants to earn something is Sarah, the woman who's trying to get into college, or I don't know, uni, college, trying to get into college. And she's trying to earn it. She's really trying to work on it, and she's trying to earn it. She keeps applying to all these colleges. And then she's about to actually get something that she's actually earned, right? She's earned her way into college. Apparently, she was a bit of a waste case in high school. So she had to make up for that and work at it and work on these applications. So she's actually earning something. She's actually earning something. And then, of course, the moment that she's about to earn something, well, terrible things happen to her because it's all the unearned. It's all about the unearned. And even at the end, I won't get into sort of the details, but even at the end, Nikki wants something that's unearned. She wants his love. And that destroys everything. I mean, everything was pretty much destroyed anyway. Wants the unearned. To give up your thirst for the unearned is so essential in life. Like, I feel very passionate about this. And I'll shut up and you can tell me what you think of this or whatever topic you want, but you have to give up your desire for the unearned. Give up your daydreaming. Unless your daydreaming is accomplished by serious action. Like, I wanted to be a writer. And I spent thousands of hours writing. I wrote like 30 plays. I've written like 10 novels. I've written hundreds of poems, essays, fiction, nonfiction. And I still didn't get what I wanted. Didn't become a big famous novelist. It's fine. Got to be nimble. I wanted to be good at philosophy. Read, studied, thought, argued, debated. And please understand, I'm not trying to say, well, just do what I do and I'm perfect. I had to very early on give up my desire for the unearned. when I was born, as I grew up and in my teens, I became a very handsome young fellow. It was relatively easy to date, very easy to date, in fact. I didn't earn that. It was just the way that I was born. My intelligence, I didn't earn that. My language skills were present from a very early age. I started writing short stories when I was 6. Pretty good ones, too. In my humble opinion, at least for 6. I wrote a novel called By the Light of an Alien Sun when I was 11. Because if you want to write, you got to write. If you want to live stream, you got to live stream. If you want to provide value, you have to first accumulate value. I am working my mind muscles to straining point to communicate essential things to you over the course of this live stream to provide value for you. I don't expect anyone to listen to me. I have to earn it every time, every sentence. People can tune in, tune out. Please, I'm begging you, give up empty daydreaming. Give up the desire for the unearned. Give up the fantasy that some girl is going to like you and approach you. As an adult, you have to earn everything you get. Everything as an adult has to be value for value trade. Would you love me if I was a worm is demanding love in the absence even of humanity? Childlike questions such as Nikki keeps asking. It's fine. And the way to give up the desire for the unearned, it's just one way. There's only one way to do it. To give up your desire for the unearned, you must grieve the theft of your childhood. When you were a kid, you needed to be loved. Like you need air, like you need water, food, shelter. You needed to be loved. And if you weren't loved, I'm really sorry. I'm like so unbelievably sorry. If I had the capacity to love every child in the world and give them parental affection and all of that, I would do it. I can't. I can try to stimulate other people into doing that. I can't do it myself. You can help other people as well. But grieving what you did not get is the only way to stop wishing for it to magically appear in the future. If you grew up poor, of course I mean spiritually, if you grew up poor, daydreaming of winning the lottery, or a magical inheritance, or tripping over gold somewhere, will only keep you poor. You have to mourn what you did not have, so you can stop fantasizing about it coming to you through magic. The people who neglected or harmed you, or both, it's two sides of the same coin, I guess, the people who neglected or harmed you in the past, they want you to daydream. They want you to daydream. Bears, the main character, Bear's single mom, we assume she's around, Bear's single mom wants him to obsess over Nikki so that he doesn't confront how neglected he was as a child, because you don't get to be that insecure, that codependent, that physically unappealing without having been woefully neglected as a child. So the people who harmed you, if you were harmed as a child, want you to fantasize about wealth or money or fame or beauty or sex or drugs or gambling or drinking or empty socializing. They want you to fantasize about that filling up the hole. Because if you stop fantasizing that there's an external solution to the problem of isolation and insecurity, if you stop fantasizing about that, then you stare at that, at how you were harmed, and you get mad at the people who harmed you. That's the only way forward. I mean, the analogy would be, if some guy punches half your teeth out, there's no point daydreaming about perfect teeth. You get mad at the person who punched your teeth out. If you were isolated, neglected, abused, ignored, scorned, mocked, ridiculed, insulted as a child, you will forever be caught in the daydreams of magical salvation until and unless you get angry at the people who did you wrong. Because the desire for the unearned means that you're very easy to exploit. The welfare state is the desire for the unearned, and it's now being exploited by all the people on the planet who can make their way to your shores by hook or by crook in one way or another. So, mourn, get angry, realize you were harmed, and then, instead of coasting on no fuel, which always means downhill, you can fill up with gas and actually get somewhere. Daydreaming only serves those who created your nightmares. Fantasy only serves those who abused and corrupted your reality when they were in charge of you. Dreaming of being loved more than anyone for no reason whatsoever that you have to earn. Well, I won't get you anywhere but hell itself. Trying to escape hell without understanding why it happened simply puts hell everywhere in front of you and every path that you take. So I hope that this is helpful. I really do appreciate your time, thoughts, care, and attention. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Lots of love, everyone. Thank you again so much. Next up, the Backrooms.